ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land. When Augusto Pinochet was arrested and charged in London in 1998, the former dictator of Chile hired the city's leading lawyers to save him. Big names. The barrister and author Philippe Sands refused to join the team, not least because his wife warned she would divorce him if he did. Sands joined the fight, but advising Human Rights Watch. His new book is an insider's account of Pinochet's trials in London and the dirty deal that saw him, spoiler alert, get home to Chile unpunished. This is a legal thriller, but it's also Sands' story of his pursuit of Walter Rauff, one of the foulest Nazis to escape to South America, who after the coup in Chile worked for Pinochet, interrogating political prisoners at a notorious address in Santiago, 38 Londres Street. Philippe Sands' powerful new book is called 38 Londres Street, On Impunity, Pinochet in England and a Nazi in Patagonia. Philippe Sands joins me now. Philippe, welcome to Late Night Live.
Incredibly nice to be with you.
Philippe, it seems to me that you come back and back in your work to a very personal question. How do monsters escape retribution?
I mean, I get to these issues, and no doubt we'll touch on some of them and some of the coincidences in due course in our conversation. But in a sense, it's an accidental pursuit. It's not that I've got a starting point and I want to find particular things. It's that I encounter a place or a person, and somehow that must connect with something deep in my being, in my psyche, that wants me to go back to periods in history when terrible things happen and ask the question that I think many of us ask: how is it that regular, decent, ordinary, cultured folk can get up to such terrible things?
And then when those terrible things crash down, those ordinary, decent folk aren't able to achieve justice.
Well, justice is, a cup that's sort of half empty. And as I've said on other occasions, a very long game. This is the story of two men, both of whom I think you can say Augusto Pinochet and Walter Rauff never got their day in court and never were convicted of the crimes of which they were alleged to have engaged. But I don't think it would be right to say that there was total impunity, because both did face, the forms of justice and got a lot of hassle in their lives and ended up in states of heightened anxiety right at the end of their lives. So justice is a really complex thing.
Yes, but they weren't behind bars, Philippe.
They weren't behind bars, and in the case of Augusto Pinochet, as you've said, I think everyone knows he's incarcerated in London. He's there for 503 days. He ends up returning to Chile, and that's one of the things that I wanted to explore, is what exactly were the circumstances of his return. And when he gets back, he's stripped of his immunity under Chilean law, and he is investigated and he's indicted. And eventually, by the time he dies, he's, in home imprisonment, can't set foot outside his house, and indicted for serial murders. So it's not that he gets off scot-free, but he's never convicted. And that leaves a bitter taste for a lot of people.
But I think the argument of your book is that the pursuit of the dictator, even though he died unpunished in a sense, that the pursuit of that dictator has left the state of international law better than it was.
Well, when Pinochet was arrested. It was the afternoon, late afternoon of the 16th of October, 1998, so about 25 years ago. It was the first time in history that a former head of state alleged to have involved in international crimes in one country is arrested in another country. And that raises the question of whether he's entitled to claim immunity from the jurisdiction of the courts, as it was of United Kingdom and of Spain. And that was groundbreaking. I think you can probably say that Pinochet was the single most significant international criminal moment since the Nuremberg trial. And it opened a new direction, which has had lots of implications in terms of causing current and former heads of state or heads of government to think very carefully before they travel internationally.
We'll come back to international heads of states traveling internationally before we're finished. But look, I want to actually start with Walter Rauff, because he is the figure that our listeners won't know. Who was Walter Rauff, and why was he on the run in South America?
So I came across Walter Rauff by accident. I was researching an earlier book in the trilogy, The Rat Line, and I came across a family archive. And in that archive, 10,000 pages, I find a letter, 3 pages, typed, sent from Damascus to Rome, addressed to Otto Wächter, who is a big Nazi on the run, main character in my book, The Rat Line. The letter advises Wächter not to come to the Arab world, not to come to Damascus, Syria, but to head to South America. In fact, Wächter dies under mysterious circumstances in a Vatican hospital. And I become intrigued as to the writer of the letter. His name is Walter Rauff. I thought I hadn't come across the name. In fact, it turned out that I had. We can come back to that later. And Rauff was another SS officer working under Reinhard Heydrich and Heinrich Himmler, who in 1941 is charged with finding a more efficient way to exterminate human beings on a large scale. And it is he who invents, operates, runs little mobile gas vans that go around central and eastern Nazi-occupied Europe, gassing people in groups of about 50. And after the war, he is indicted for that act, and he goes on the run, and he goes initially to Syria, but later ends up in Chile. In fact, as I mentioned, I had come across Walter Rauff, but I'd forgotten that I'd come across him. There is a book by the renowned British writer Bruce Chatwin. He'll be known in Australia, and I think somewhat controversially, for his book The Songlines, but he wrote a book called In Patagonia, and chapter 96 is dedicated to Walter Rauff. They had come across each other in some way in the southern Chilean town of Punta Arenas in the late 1970s.
Your critique of Chatwin in Patagonia so mirrors critiques of Chatwin in Songlines. Gripping, vivid, but dot, 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 dot. So you knew you had known of him, but then you set about investigating whether he had been a helper of Pinochet after the coup. And I must say, I'm incredibly impressed by your hesitation to come to any easy conclusion about that. The whole of the book, in a sense, is an exploration of that question. But you do come to a conclusion.
I do. I come to a very clear conclusion with no doubts, and I'll come to that in a moment. But just on Bruce Chatwin, since it is of interest also in Australia.
You brought him up.
I brought him up because, well, I went down to Punta Arenas with a copy of In Patagonia in hand, looking to find the characters or their descendants that he wrote about, that he claimed to have met in Punta Arenas. It turned out that half of them never existed. They were pure invention. And this was, of course, supposed to be a non-fiction book. So that, of course, coloured my sense of the veracity and truthfulness of Chadwick. He's still a terrific writer, but I mean, a lot of it, frankly, is invented. So I mean, the story of Rauff, he escapes Damascus. He heads first with his wife and 2 kids to Ecuador and sets up shop in Quito, the capital of Ecuador. He and his wife Edith then meet an absolutely charming couple who say, you know what, you are in the wrong country. Why don't you come to our country, to Chile? We like people like you, big German community. And in 58, the Ralphs head off to Chile. They set up shop in Punta Arenas. Ralph becomes the manager of a king crab cannery, eventually the Pesquera Camelio. In 63, he is actually arrested, manages to avoid extradition to West Germany because of the statute of limitations. The crimes have happened too long ago for him to be extradited from Chile. And then in September 73, on the day of the coup, September the 11th, miracle of miracles, his friend from Quito, Ecuador, becomes the new head of state of Chile because it is none other than Augusto Pinochet. So that, I thought, was rather remarkable. And that, of course, triggered the question in my brain, could it be that Ralph resumed his nefarious career doing horrible things after Pinochet took power? And what prompted that thought was there were masses of rumors. If you go on the web, you'll find lots of stuff saying Ralph did this, Ralph did that, Ralph, you know, disappeared people. But I couldn't find any evidence. I mean, I'm a courtroom lawyer. I do cases at the international courts. I'm interested in hard evidence, witnesses, documents, anything that will prove, you know, when a judge says to you, what's your evidence, Mr. Sands? You can't just waffle. You've got to come up with something.
Yes.
And I couldn't find anything. So I went on a hunt. Now, one of the things the Chileans did, they sort of learnt from their German counterparts all the documents relating to the DINA, which was the feared intelligence, secret intelligence police of Pinochet, were destroyed in 1977. They'd got into difficulty with the Americans. So there's no documentary evidence. I had to find witnesses. And eventually I find basically half a dozen people who are able to tell me of their direct personal encounters with Walter Ralph. And that becomes the basis for the firm conclusion that I end up reaching.
You're a lawyer who's not at all satisfied with documents. You hunt down people and then you interrogate them. And this is a book of interrogations. It's one of the great pleasures of reading it, is to be there as you interrogate, with occasional, Philippe, fashion notes. You let us know what people are wearing and occasionally what the view is out the window. But these are lawyers' interrogations in remote places. And as you hunt down the truth, they're very pleasing. And you get to the truth of Ralph. Now, I want to go back to a lawyer's point you made, talking about the statutes of limitations. There are some societies who say a crime is too old to prosecute. You and I don't live in such countries, but there are such countries. The United States is one, isn't it, for the most part? And why are such statutes in existence? Why do some countries have this notion that if a criminal can go unpunished long enough, their crimes are forgotten?
Well, I think every country has limitation periods for certain crimes. I mean, if you or I engage in shoplifting, if we do it tomorrow, in 10 years' time, we get apprehended, there's going to be a limitation period, I suspect, in England and in most parts of Australia, if not all of Australia. Mm. The issue that we're concerned with here is international crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, torture, disappearing human beings. And the position in Chile in 1963 was that the crimes for which Ralph was to be extradited were included, for example, murder. And murder had in Chilean law in 1963 a 15-year limitation period. So because the crimes that were alleged to have been committed by Ralph had occurred in 41 and 42, the murder of people in the gas vans, by 1963, the 15-year period had passed and he couldn't be extradited for that. They then sort of tried to amend the indictment to include genocide on the basis they thought that genocide had no limitation period. But the difficulty for that was that Chile had only become a party to the Genocide Convention in the mid-1950s, and so it did not apply to crimes that were committed in 1941 and 42. So these are sort of technical ways of getting around. Now, the bottom line is, as of today, when it comes to international crimes, many of which are in the news, and many of your listeners will be aware of the things that are going on in various parts of the world and allegations about crimes that are taking place, when an international crime is concerned, the basic rule now is there is no limitation period. So if someone commits a crime today in 2025 and they are only apprehended 32 years later, for an international crime of that kind, there'll be no limitation period as a matter of international law. That's a change that follows on from the famous Nuremberg trial.
Tell us about the origins of the notion of international crimes, because this is central to your work.
It is. And as you know, I mean, this trilogy begins with my book, East West Street, which started with an accidental invitation to go to this city of Lviv in Ukraine to give a lecture on the cases that I do on crimes against humanity and genocide. And I then discover, of course, that crimes against humanity and genocide originate in Lviv with two former students of its university, Raphael Lemkin and Hersch Lauterpacht. I had not expected to discover that. It was completely coincidental. The work of Lauterpacht and Lemkin is then integrated into the statute of the famous Nuremberg Tribunal with, you know, strong Australian involvement, actually, in those proceedings, as well as in the parallel Tokyo proceedings. And you then get to a situation in 45-46 where, for the first time, you've got a list of international crimes. War crimes had existed for about a century, and then added in 1945 are crimes against humanity, a sort of formulation put together by Hersch Lauterpacht, a professor from Cambridge, and this famous concept of genocide invented by Raphael Lemkin. And those three crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, to all intents and purposes, continue to operate today. There is a fourth international crime. It's quite in the news, and that is the crime of aggression, waging a manifestly illegal war. And that is much in the news in relation to the Russian invasion and occupation of parts of Ukraine. But essentially, the current system that we have of international justice finds its origins in 1945. And what was so significant about the Pinochet case was it took some of those crimes, allegations of torture and disappearance and other crimes against humanity, from the international level to the national level. And what the English courts had to deal with is, can a former head of state claim immunity where those crimes are alleged and where those crimes have been committed far away and not involving British nationals? That was what was so novel about the Pinochet proceedings.
Before we leave the notion of genocide, I think Australia has to claim its part in the definition of genocide, because, of course, Lemke drew on the experience of the indigenous peoples of Van Diemen's Land being wiped out as part of his studies. But let's go to Mr. Pinochet, who was warned by his army mates not to go to London, but he wanted to get his back fixed. So off he went in October 1998 to the London Clinic. Who was after him at that point and why?
So just a little bit for your listeners who may not know exactly what he'd got up to. He takes power on September the 11th, 1973.
This is a very good idea, yes. Takes power in 73.
He takes power. He becomes the head of a four-man military junta. It's a dictatorship. Tens of thousands of people are arrested. Many of them are disappeared. To this day, more than 1,300 people are still disappeared. Tens of thousands were tortured. Many were killed. He stays in office until 1990. He then leaves the presidency, becomes head of the army, and gives himself an absolute immunity and a total amnesty in relation to allegations of wrongdoing. So by October 1998, when he travels to Britain to visit, in part, his great friend Margaret Thatcher, to go shopping for books at Hatchards and to buy clothes and get an operation on his back, he's no longer got a formal office. He's still a senator for life, and he has absolute immunity under Chilean law. And he believes that with that, he is immune from the jurisdiction of the English courts. So he arrives in Britain with that belief. He spends a few days shopping, buying Star Wars movies, buying books about Napoleon. It's always these points of detail that I find so fascinating.
Can I just stop you there for a moment? I really think it counts against Pinochet that he is an avid fan of books about Napoleon. It's not a good sign, is it?
Well, it's interesting. It's not a good sign, but you will have noticed just a few weeks ago, President Trump suddenly started quoting Napoleon, and I think there is an issue when you stop buying books about Napoleon and quoting Napoleon. I think you're entering dangerous territory. So he's in London. He goes in for an operation on his back to the London Clinic on Devonshire Place. And on the evening of the 16th of October, 1998, at about 11 o'clock at night, he is arrested for murder, crimes against humanity, genocide, on a request from Spain, from a judge called Balthasar Garzon, who has learnt that he's in London on a tip-off from a group of Chilean refugees and various non-governmental organisations like Amnesty, like Human Rights Watch, that this fellow is in London and is subject to arrest. But it is a Spanish judge, Balthasar Garzon, working off the back of a case that had in fact had been invented a couple of years earlier by another Spanish prosecutor called Carlos Castresana, and they have constructed the case, which allows them to argue that Spain has jurisdiction for international crimes committed in Chile by Augusto Pinochet. As you know from the book, when Carlos Castresana, the prosecutor who really started this whole thing, was looking at how to start the case, he was concerned about the conservatism of Spanish courts and suggested to the Chilean refugees who had come to him that it would be sensible to find a Spanish victim in relation to the crimes that have been committed, because with a Spanish victim, it's more likely that the Spanish courts would give the green light to opening the case and proceeding. The Chilean refugees come back with various names. Castresana chooses one. I'd never heard of that person. It's a man called Carmelo Soria. And he had been a dual Spanish-Chilean national. He'd been in Santiago. He was the head of a United Nations office. And he disappears on the 14th of July, 1976. He's quite well-known. He comes from a well-known Spanish family. Castresana chooses that case to start the whole proceedings. We're now in 1996. I happen, when I'm told all this by Carlos Castresana, to be with my beloved mother-in-law in Totnes in Devon, visiting her. Tell her the story. You need to understand, dear listeners, that she is herself, my mother-in-law, a Spanish refugee who came to Britain in 1940 from the Spanish Civil War. And she listens to me carefully and says to me, what was the name of the fellow who got the whole case going again? I say, Carmelo Soria. She looks at me and she says, ah, yes, of course, I'd forgotten. Cousin Carmelo. And so it turned out, unbelievably, that we were connected to the start of the whole Pinochet case. Philip, and knew nothing about.
Philip, I have to stop things here and just alert the listeners to the fact that this is a book where you are able to call on the most extraordinary connections. There's somebody you have to talk to who lives over the road. There's somebody you have to talk to who turns out to be a distant cousin. There's somebody you have to talk to whose dentist was your father. And you get through all these doors.
Where should we begin?
Yes. You have a connection everywhere.
Well, this is a subject of much dispute that I have with my wife, because she thinks it's all total coincidence. Whereas I think there are other factors at play, that there's something else that's going on. So let's just take one of the characters that you mentioned, and then you can come back on others that we might want to talk about. The man who signed the arrest warrant for Augusto Pinochet at about 8 p.m. London time on the Friday, the 16th of October, 1998.
This is an Englishman, not a Spaniard.
This is an Englishman now. The request for arrest has flown over by the internet, by fax, to London from Madrid, goes to Scotland Yard. Scotland Yard send it to the duty magistrate. The duty magistrate is one Nicholas Evans of Christchurch Hill, Hampstead, London, NW3. And he signs the arrest warrant. In fact, he makes a mistake in signing the arrest warrant. We can come back to that. And he never gives an interview to anybody. Now, the only thing I would say about this is Nicholas Evans happens to be literally my next door neighbor, our gardens touch. And I've known for years about this. And one day I say to him, can I ask you about exactly what happened? And he says, well, yeah, you're my neighbor. I'll give you the account of what happened. And he's very generous. And I go over on a Sunday morning and he tells me the whole story of what happened. And I've set it out in the book. His wife pops her head round the corner at about 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Cup of tea, Philippe, or something stronger. I settled on tea at that point of the day. And he gives me a wonderful account of the arrival of, you know, the extradition squad from Scotland Yard, with a piece of paper, which seeks the arrest of Augusto Pinochet for genocide and crimes against humanity. And as Nick Evans said to me, Philippe, I'm not like you. I didn't do international law and that kind of stuff. I'd never come across these concepts, torture, genocide. So I crossed them out and I wrote murder. And that turned out to be a major problem because the English courts do not have jurisdiction over the crime of murder committed in Chile because it's not an international crime. The situation was later addressed very quickly.
Yep. One of the wonders of this book is the way in which you investigate the mistakes that lawyers make. I'm not sure that the lawyers are particularly fond of you as a result, but nevertheless. Now, on Late Night Live, I'm speaking to the lawyer and writer Philippe Sands about his new book, 38 Londres Street, which involves, in part, the arrest of Augusto Pinochet in London. So the Spaniards send the request over. The general is arrested.
But actually, let's just have a word on the arrest because it's just too delicious to pass over.
It is, yes.
To know the interpreter, who actually is my favourite character in the whole book.
She's a wonderful character.
Isn't she wonderful?
Yeah,
what did you love about her?
Well, she's there all the time. She's dour. She's absolutely dour. I trust her judgment completely. And she's just present.
She's present.
She's present.
She just tells a fantastic story. So she gets the call on the Friday evening, Scotland Yard, Jean, we need an interpreter. We're arresting someone and the person doesn't speak any English, so we need you. She's a dual Spanish-English translator. She's half Chilean, half English. So she toddles off to Scotland Yard and they turn up at the London Clinic at about 11 o'clock at night, go up to the 8th floor, room 801, a couple of Chilean guards who have to be removed to gain access. A nurse goes in, wakes Pinochet up. He's in his pyjamas, sits up in bed. Jean goes in with the Scotland Yard detectives, and she is the one who informs him that he is under arrest for murder and genocide and crimes against humanity. And, of course, when you're in the presence of Jean, you just want to know every detail of what happened. And I remember saying to her, so how did he react? She said, oh, he just looked at me and he said, I know the fucker who's behind this. It's Juan Garcés, the lawyer in Spain. And of course, he was spot on. He was absolutely incandescent with fury. That was Jean Pateras' first encounter with Augusto Pinochet. And she's then with him all the way to the end of the story and literally wheels him onto the plane 503 days later at a small airport in Lincolnshire when he's flown back to Santiago. So she's with him when the judgments come out from the House of Lords. She sees him weeping. She sees him eating dulce de leche cakes. She sees him watching Star Wars movie. She sees him pretending to be infirm, pretending to be demented. She is an amazing character.
And when she goes into the room, and I love the detail that the Chilean guards who'd been standing in the corridor of the London Clinic then go over the road and have a bit of a smoke and don't really know what to do.
She finds them afterwards. They leave and they're standing in their streets with a hand on their chest. I think she said it was raining. And they're just utterly bemused because El General is being, you know, is now under arrest and subject to Her Majesty's detention. So it's a shock for these characters, as it was for many people in Chile, as it was for many people around the world.
And then he faced a series of proceedings that you're part of for the book. You interview everybody. And it has to be said that Pinochet assembles a first-class bunch of British lawyers.
Yeah, it's a superb team led by a couple of QCs, Clive Nichols and Claire Montgomery. I think Claire Montgomery is the standout star advocate in the whole case.
God, she's brisk.
She's brisk, she's tough, she's really smart. But the other thing that has happened, we've just sort of passed over it. It's not so much that I refused to act for him. It's more that when I told my wife that I'd been approached by Augusto Pinochet's lawyers to argue that he was entitled to full immunity under the English legal system. She said, well, are you going to do it? And I explained, we have this thing that I think you have also in parts of Australia, the cab rank principle as barristers.
Oh, yes, of course.
We can't say we don't like the cut of someone's jib or their politics or their colour or whatever. You you act for everybody, and so you do. And I have acted for many people, some of whom are decent folk, some of whom are less decent folk. And I believe in the cab rank principle. And she said, well, are you going to do it? And I said, well, cab rank principle. And she said, I know about the cab rank principle. What you need to know about my wife is she's an American lawyer. She thinks the cab rank principle is a nonsense. They don't have it in.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And I say, well, you know, cab rank principle. She said, well, okay, you can do it if you want to do it. But if you do it, I will divorce you tomorrow. So I didn't do it. Mm. I did manage to find a way out. The cab rank principle has, the rule has exceptions, and one of them is called professional embarrassment. And actually, thankfully, I had done an interview 5 days earlier on the BBC World Service where I'd been pushed and pushed and pushed on whether a former head of state is entitled to claim immunity. And I said, eventually, well, we don't know. It's never happened before. And then I said, well, I can see why a serving head of state will be able to claim full immunity, but I can't see the rationale for a former head of state where international crimes are alleged. And so I said, no, I don't think he should have immunity. And that allowed me to get out, because effectively I would be arguing in favor of a proposition that I had publicly undermined in a radio interview. So I didn't do it. And to be honest, I was a bit disappointed because it was such an interesting and important case. But a few days later, Human Rights Watch came along and I spent much of the case sitting in court for Human Rights Watch, sitting, as you know, next to some remarkable characters, including someone who became something of a friend throughout the entire proceedings before the various cases in the House of Lords, the Judicial Committee. I sat next to a man called Miguel Schweitzer, who was, well, the first time I met him, which was on the opening day of the proceedings in early November 98, he holds out his hand and says, Miguel Schweitzer, I was the human rights advisor to Augusto Pinochet from 1975 to 1984 or some such
cracker thing. Job he did, Philippe. Cracker job.
Cracker job. I mean, yep, absolutely. But the thing is, there is a sort of, you know, when you're in court and sitting next to the same person day in, day out, and he was very genial, there's a sort of Stockholm syndrome thing that builds up and you get talking. And we stayed in touch for the next 20 years. And of course, at the end of the day, we became mates and he told me a lot of marvelous stories.
He was a very useful source.
Oh, he was wonderful. I mean, I had another very useful source, which is that my best friend in the world, who actually, I should say this, is an Australian, James Cameron, but practicing as an English barrister, took my seat, if you like, acting for Augusto Pinochet. So I found myself opposite my very best friend in the world, which for 6 months was, I have to say, pretty tough, because the case was very contentious, very tense indeed. But we're still best mates today. And he, of course, was able to share with me, within the limits of, you know, professional responsibilities, what he could. And so I learned a lot about the arguments on the other side. And over time, you know, with the passage of 25 years, there's much more that can be said, which is, I think, why so many people were now able and willing to speak to me.
One of the themes of the book, I don't know that it's a theme, but it just keeps cropping up, is how polite everybody is to one another and how that politeness is appreciated. And scrupulously polite is said of some quite horrible people. And it's very British in that sense. There's this sort of resident goodwill and scrupulous behaviour throughout.
It's really interesting you say that. That's a really interesting observation. It is true. As you say it, I realise it's true. And I think that it's premised on a courtesy based out of respect. You know, when I approach people who've often never talked about these issues, for example, Nicholas Evans, who I talked about before, or Miguel Schweitzer, or maybe we'll come on to it, Lord Hoffman, who was one of the judges in the House of Lords proceedings.
He's up next.
Great. They will only really talk to me if they feel I'm going to treat them fairly. And that means, you know, putting into the book, really in a sense, not every word they say, but reflecting what they say in a balanced way so that it's not taken out of context. I'm not looking to score points. I'm not looking to attack anybody. And it's that relationship of trust in the conversations that I think becomes very important. I mean, I think one of the reasons the book has some degree of effectiveness is that I've spoken to people on all sides, you know, on Pinochet's side, for Pinochet, against Pinochet, the judges, the administrators. And I think that means the reader gets a balanced view. You'll have picked up that my style is not to impose on the reader my own views, my own conclusions, but to leave it to the reader, who is intelligent, to form their own view about what happened.
On ABC Radio National Summer, this is Late Night Live, and I'm speaking to Philip Sands about the crimes of Augusto Pinochet. Now, the British judges whom this sort of arrest warrant came before had to decide whether this man had immunity. So the Lords of Appeal, how many of them? Five of them.
Five in the first case. Yeah.
Five in the first case. They have to sit there and decide, does this man have immunity? If he had immunity, it was all over. And what did those five find?
Right. Immunity basically says the English courts have no power to exercise jurisdiction over this individual. And if the judges had ruled he had immunity, as the first instance court had ruled unanimously, Augusto Pinochet would immediately, within an hour, be flying back to Chile. So we get to the, you know, we're in the Palace of Westminster, in the House of Lords chamber. The five judges speak. It was, I think I can honestly say, the most dramatic moment of my legal life. The first law lord speaks and argues, concludes Pinochet has complete immunity, 1-0 to Pinochet. The second law lord speaks, full immunity for Pinochet, 2-0 for Pinochet. We're looking like we're going down here. Then third law lord speaks, no immunity for Pinochet, 2-1. The fourth law lord speaks, no immunity for Pinochet, 2-2 draw. And there's one law lord left, Lord Leonard Hoffman. Now, of the five law lords during the hearings, the only one we thought was on our side, that's to say on Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, Spain side against immunity, was Lord Hoffman. And at that point, I think the penny dropped and we realized, wow, he's going to rule there's no immunity and Pinochet will have no immunity. And that was exactly what happened. And it went 3-2 against Pinochet. And you can watch that moment on the BBC archive. It's easy to find. And you'll hear a sharp intake of breath, some murmurs, some shouting. It's as though the world legal system had turned on its axis. Jean Pateras, the interpreter, was with Pinochet at that moment. They watched the hearing together. It was live on worldwide television. And I asked Jean what happened. And she said that he wept, he cried, because he realized he was going to be staying. It was one of the most dramatic moments I've ever lived through in any legal system, in any legal proceeding.
And you write that that was the moment in which the law appeared to turn away from the sovereign towards the individual, away from the perpetrator towards the victim. In an instant, the impunity associated with the crimes of the sovereign was stripped away. But there was a problem.
Well, there was a problem. We go home that evening. In fact, we invited the Human Rights Watch team over for supper that evening, and we watched a late night BBC TV show that you may have come across called Newsnight, hosted by one Jeremy Paxman, who starts the show with a discussion on the Pinochet case. There's a panel of a few people, and amongst the people is a senator from Chile, Evelyn Matte, who actually right now, 25 years on, is a leading candidate to be the next president of Chile. And she says to Jeremy Paxman, look, there's a problem here. Lord Hoffman is associated with the non-governmental organization Amnesty International. His wife works for Amnesty. He's got some other connection with them. Paxman sort of swats it away and says, oh, you know, stop, you're just upset because you lost. But no, it turns out there is a problem. Two problems. Firstly, as has been mentioned, Lord Hoffman's wife, Gillian Hoffman, works for Amnesty as an administrative person. And secondly, Lord Hoffman himself serves on the board of a charitable arm of Amnesty International. And normally what would happen in such cases is that a judge would, at the beginning of the hearing, make a public statement. These are my connections with one of the parties. But he didn't do it. The lawyers for Pinochet told me that if he had done it, they would not have objected and he would have continued to sit. But he didn't do it. And that became a problem. What happens next is the Pinochet team challenge the entire judgment. It's never happened in hundreds of years of the House of Lords Judicial Committee. And they bring a proceeding to set aside the judgment on the grounds of Lord Hoffman's appearance of bias. And they succeed. And another panel of five law lords, different panel, rule that the case has to be set aside and we start again, which means that a few weeks later, by now we're in sort of January, February 1999, the entire case on immunity starts again, this time before a panel of seven judges, different judges, and they rule once again that Augusto Pinochet has no immunity, but they do it on much narrower grounds. So the consequence of their ruling is that his loss of immunity only takes effect from late 1988. And the consequence of that is there is only one act of torture left behind on which he could be extradited. And the law lords basically say to Jack Straw, the Home Secretary, given that there's only one case left, you should probably send him back home to Chile. And so the case then goes back into the in-tray of the Home Secretary, Jack Straw, and he has to decide what to do. And what he tells me is that he was so irritated with the Lenny Hoffman saga, amongst other issues, that he decided, no, he would give an authority to proceed for Pinochet to be extradited to Spain. And so that was the direction that things were going to take until another factor intervened.
Now, the other factor, I would observe at this point that none of the governments were happy much with what was going on. The Spanish government wasn't happy at all. This whole process was begun by Spanish prosecutors who were very keen to get Pinochet. The British government wasn't particularly happy with Pinochet being a prisoner in Britain either, and the Chilean government wasn't happy either. It was all being fought out amongst the lawyers. And with the prospect of Pinochet being sent to Spain to stand trial in Spain, with that prospect once again in sight, a deal was done. And this I find truly shocking. Tell us about the deal. Who did the deal? Why?
So what ends up happening is in March 2000, to cut straight to the chase, Augusto Pinochet is sent back from London to Santiago by a decision of Jack Straw to the effect that he is not fit to stand trial. He's infirm. Straw has received some medical reports and he's accepted those medical reports and decided the safest option is to send him back to Chile. And that's what happens. Now, when that happened, many people suspected some deal had been done, some arrangement had been entered into, something had happened. But no one has ever been able to discover what exactly happened, if it was true that there was a deal, or in fact, if indeed he was sent back just because he was medically infirm. So that's one of the main features of the book, is I explore that issue. And eventually, I find the chief Chilean negotiator with the United Kingdom, a man called Christian Tolosa, who has been selected by the Chilean president, President Frei. He's his chief speechwriter, because he's got a PhD in psychology, which he has taken at a British university, the University of Exeter, and he is believed to know how the British mind works. And Tolosa actually is a remarkable character. He plays a blinder, plays the British, develops a strategy to get Pinochet back, which is premised on the artifice that he's unfit to stand trial. And Tolosa told me exactly how they proceeded to do that, which included the preparation of a dossier for General Pinochet to teach him how to pretend he was demented or gaga or infirm. And indeed, again, this coincides with stories told to me by Jean Pateras, where she finds him, you know, pretending to be infirm mentally, physically, unfit to stand trial.
And who was this remarkably clever envoy talking to? In whose office was he making these arguments?
I've learned as a lawyer in court, it's often not entirely safe to rely on one account or one form of testimony. You really want another one. So
journalists are in much the same position very often.
He told me he'd been speaking to a man called Jonathan Powell. This came as a surprise to me. This had not been in the newspapers. It was widely known. Jonathan Powell is a renowned and revered and highly respected figure. I mean, I've always held him in great esteem. He was Tony Blair's chief of staff at 10 Downing Street for 10 years. And it was in that capacity that Tolosa intervened with him. Powell is very famous as the architect of the Good Friday Agreement, which has brought peace to Northern Ireland, an extraordinary achievement. I reached out to him. He agreed to meet with me. And he went back to his notes from that period, and he confirmed everything that Tolosa had told me, and that there was a deal, an agreement. Now, the interesting thing here is that Jack Straw, who I've also interviewed, denies he knew anything about an agreement or a deal, and his lawyer, Jonathan Sumption, has said the same thing. But I think they were simply kept out of the loop, although it was in their choice of medical doctors that you really get to see where the mischief was done. Now, interestingly, on the subject of medical doctors, Scotland Yard had their own medical doctor, a rather impressive character called Peter Dean, who I've also spent time with. He attended medically to General Pinochet from day three of his arrest all the way to the end. And when he heard rumours that General Pinochet was going to be sent back to Chile because he was unfit to stand trial, he intervenes directly with Jack Straw. He writes to Jack Straw and says, look, this is ridiculous. I'm attending to him. He's absolutely fine. He's a bit frail, but he absolutely is fit to stand trial. I'm a medical examiner for Scotland Yard. I'm an expert in this area. What happens next? Peter Dean is relieved of his duties. And you stitch together the elements of the story and it becomes crystal clear what has happened.
But they've why? Sent him back. But why?
Because it's become an embarrassment.
Is it because it's become an embarrassment? Is it because also that there's a kind of debt to Pinochet because he sided with Britain in the war with Argentina?
Well, that, you know, to be honest, when I started researching this, I was not aware of the scale of the support that Chile had given the United Kingdom in the Falklands-Malvinas War back in 1982. It was about 15 years earlier, but it turned out that Augusto Pinochet had provided extraordinary support to the British, including an airstrip near Punta Arenas, from where the British were able to refuel and do logistics and supplies, but also to attack Argentine naval vessels. And certainly Pinochet believed that the support he'd given the British would contribute to his impregnability and his immunity. And I think under a conservative government, his great friend was Margaret Thatcher, he probably would have been safer. One of the things that comes out from Jack Straw's accounts is that, you know, Margaret Thatcher bombarding Tony Blair with letters on why Blair should send Pinochet back to Chile. And so the politics of that issue, I think you're right.
And she sent him, Margaret Thatcher sent him back with a gift. His plane had to wait 20 minutes on the tarmac for his gift, for Margaret Thatcher's gift to arrive, which was what? A plate celebrating?
Platter. It was a platter. She gives it to his solicitor, the lovely Michael Kaplan, who rushes off to the airport in Lincolnshire to, you know, bearing a large platter bearing an image of the British defeating the Spanish Armada in 1588 or some such thing. And that is given to Pinochet on the plane. And he is apparently, according to Miguel Schweitzer, delighted to have it.
Now, Philippe, Pinochet is put onto the plane by a lift taking his wheelchair up into the plane. However, when he gets to Santiago, yes, he comes off the plane in the wheelchair, but he just immediately gets up and starts walking. He seems perfectly healthy once he gets to Santiago. I suppose it's getting home. You've already foreshadowed that by the time he died a few years later, he was facing an absolute mountain of prosecution. And I've got this brutal clock in front of me, which tells me we've only got a couple of minutes left. So I'm going to ask you about some of the implications for this story today. How is it that Netanyahu can fly around the world
despite the fact that the International Criminal Court has issued a warrant for his arrest for crimes against humanity. Isn't this precisely what the Pinochet case was supposed to establish, that heads of state were vulnerable?
It did establish that, and it has contributed to that effect. Now, what you're referring to in relation to Netanyahu and also Putin is that they've been indicted not by national courts, but by the International Criminal Court in The Hague, to which, of course, Australia is a party. So neither Putin nor Netanyahu could travel to Australia or Britain or any other party to the ICC statute, because those countries would have an obligation to arrest and extradite to The Hague, to the ICC, if he were to set foot in that country. So what they have been doing is trying to find those countries that are willing to ignore that rule. Mr. Putin didn't go to South Africa, you'll recall, because there was a fear he might be arrested. Yes. South Africa is a party to the ICC statute. But he did travel to Mongolia, which is a party, and they just ignored the requirement. Similarly, just a few days ago, Mr. Netanyahu flew to Hungary, which said it was withdrawing from the statute of the International Criminal Court, but nevertheless breached its obligation to arrest him. He's also been to the United States, but there a different situation pertains, because the US is not a party to the ICC statute, so they don't have to arrest him and send him to The Hague. But the basic rule is there, and I think the reality actually is that he's not free to travel. Neither of these men, Putin or Netanyahu, are free to travel around the world. There is a risk of arrest. And so what they are likely to be doing is getting legal advice and political and diplomatic advice. If I go to X or Y country, what is likely to happen? And I'm sure, as in the UK, the Australian government has turned its mind to the question, if he were to turn up in Australia, or Mr. Putin were to turn up in Australia, what would we be obliged to do? Now, incidentally, on the subject of extradition, I should just say there is a connection with my book. Australia currently has a detainee who's about to be extradited to Chile for alleged involvement in some of the crimes in which Walter Rauf and Augusto Pinochet were involved. And her name is Adriana Rivera. And I believe the Australian courts have just about now decided she can be extradited to Chile. So there is a very current Australian angle in all of these issues.
And Walter Rauf, to end on this shabby, disgusting figure, how did he end his days?
He ended his days living in Santiago, retiring from the king crab cannery, being hunted by Mossad, who actually turn up at his door and get within, I would say, about 48 yards of assassinating him, until he's saved by his dog, the vicious Alsatian called Rex, dies in 1984 of cancer, oblivious to the fact that he's been hunted by Mossad, but requested by Margaret Thatcher and President Mitterrand and others to be sent back to Germany, which request is refused by Augusto Pinochet, who will then face his own analogous extradition proceedings 14 years later. There is a sort of cross-fertilization between these stories, which is unexpected, but to me very striking.
Philippe, thank you so much for talking to us on Late Night Live about the new book, 38 Londres Street. And you will be in Australia in May for the Sydney Writers' Festival, various events at the time, which we will alert our listeners to. Thanks so much.
It's a real pleasure to be with you.
And that's the show of the week. Just one more week of summer specials to come. Next week, we'll revisit the story of Australia's last outlaws. Meet the young German who's running the biggest dig in Pompeii in a generation. And we'll enjoy once again long, thoughtful conversations with Canberra veteran John Menadue and comedian Tim Minchin. My thanks as always to the tireless Late Night Live team and the woman who gave us our theme, Elena Katz-Chernin. Until next week. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.